Simon, welcome to this week's VFX show. This week we're looking at the film Gravity. In a moment I'll be joined by Matt Wallen and also Jason Diamond, who were joined as this week's co-hosts. The show was recorded 2 days ago at the FX Guide complex here, the tech bunker, as we like to call it, and it was done as a Google Hangout. Now, I just want to flag this for a couple of you, and I quite frankly just want to be kind of open and honest with you. So what we decided to do is we wanted to move the VFX show so it would be able to be available as both a live Google Hangout with us being able to show you clips and show you sort of great behind the scenes shots and things that we've gotten from researching the films as we do for FX Guide, and of course provide the audio-only podcast. And we think the audio podcast is really important because I know a lot of you listen to this while you're driving and commuting to work and stuff, and so just having a video option maybe doesn't work for everyone. The great thing about the Google Hangout, though, is if you can't see it live and you are in a position that maybe you're on a train and you can actually download it and watch it or get streaming, depending on what part of the world you're in, then you can, in fact, watch the video version as an alternative. So in this transitional phase, and I'm just being totally honest with you, we're trying to perfect a really high-quality show, and we're kind of learning as we go. I guess we could have done this as an offline exercise, but rather than sort of waste the shows and just bin them, we decided that we would actually put them out. So I guess I'm heartfelt apologies, but I'm just saying that I don't think the audio quality of the last couple of shows, or this one for that matter, are yet there. We're going to be improving them as we go along. We're improving the technology we're using and learning a lot as we go to get really high quality results for you. And already we've made huge leaps and bounds. But anyway, we'll jump to the show this week. As I say, it's recorded as a Google Hangout, and we'll be fine-tuning that as we go along. But again, thanks so much for your patience. We really do appreciate it, and it's certainly a learning exercise for us. Okay, well, now joining me for the discussion is Matt Wallen and Jason Diamond as we get into the film Gravity. So we're discussing the film Gravity, and as we like to do each week on the show, we're going to discuss what we think of the film and then the visual effects in it. And rarely has there been a film as, I guess, anticipated and, I guess, well-received by the VFX community, Matt, as this one. This has done really well this year.
Yeah, I mean, it is, I would say, an incredible movie. I think I can say right now that the competition for the visual effects Oscar is over. I think it's clearly the runaway movie in terms of visual effects. It is wholly unique in its scope and presentation, I think. But yeah, I mean, it's an amazing, amazing feat of filmmaking. Really very impressive.
Jason, what do you think?
I agree. I think it's the only movie you have to see in 3D, much less IMAX 3D. And I don't like 3D unless it's like animated kids movies. And I think that also, technologically, it's an insane advance in even over Avatar, I think.
Yeah, it's a different kind of film than Avatar in a sense that the characters aren't fictional, and so consequently you've got a really strong sort of barometer to hold them against. This is also a relatively modestly budgeted film for a major Hollywood film. Okay, it's not a small film. It's like kicking in around 80 mil, but it's certainly not one of those 150, 250 mil. It's you could make several of these for Lone Ranger, for example. And quite frankly, I wish they would.
yeah, no doubt.
So, Matt, let's discuss the film just from a cinematic point of view. It's about 90 minutes long, so it's clearly has a hallmark, a DNA, going back to Children of Men, of these very, very long shots. But here in 3D, and in this environment of zero gravity where people clearly float around, those very, very long shots just seem to be so in sync with the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's jam-packed in the 90 minutes that make up and constitute the film in total. And I think in that respect, it's incredibly impressive. I think, you know, if I were to have any qualms with the film at all, they would be on the level of some of the script with regards to dialogue and the way that some of the dialogue is delivered in the first, probably the first quarter to the first third of the movie. I found that some of the dialogue interactions between the George Clooney character and Mission Control and or the Sandra Bullock character were kind of, for me, they felt a little ham-fisted. They felt a little clumsy in places. It seemed the call and response you know, was so quick and so rapid. And then I just found the film to be much more, it was visually always, I thought, really groundbreaking and just amazing and beautiful to look at. But as an immersive story, I found myself much more engaged and interested in the film, spoiler alert, by the way, after George Clooney's demise. I thought the film took on a much more interesting veneer after that, when it was just sort of the lone survivor. And there was something about, even when the trailers for this movie were coming out, that was my only thing that I sort of had even any concerns about with regards to the movie, given the pedigree of the director and you know, sort of the anticipation of this whole, the scope of this idea, which seems so incredibly fascinating. It reminds me a lot of, you know, it made me think a lot of The Old Man and the Sea, right? The book that takes place, the Hemingway book, with the one character, you know, at sea fishing for a long time, and just sort of that kind of isolation and in a human sort of out of the element kind of manner. But then the only thing that I was really kind of not sure about was the casting. I thought the casting was sort of unusual choices. I mean, obviously major Hollywood bankable stars in the two heavies in the picture, but at the same time I wasn't sure that they were going to be able to carry the film and convey the appropriate kind of sort of realism that I think the film was kind of going for. And for me, I thought the Sandra Bullock character, well, I couldn't believe she would be an astronaut given her, in some ways, like, lack of experience, and the fact that in the script there was a lack of, it was as if they'd never discussed anything together. And I would imagine on a mission like that, you would have spent months and months training. You would actually know each other pretty well. And there were a lot of scenes where it was like they were just sort of getting to know one another. It's almost as if they didn't even know each other's names, you know. That seemed a little bit of a stretch for me. But I do think that upon Clooney's demise in the picture, aside from his slight, you know, reappearance briefly, I was sort of, I enjoyed the film as a movie and as a plot-driven narrative more after he had departed. There was something about
I'm going to disagree with you on that one. I liked the impending sense of doom that was happening from this whole kind of sense of it suddenly flying in and coming back around. This idea that they were going to have the loop around of the stuff going around the Earth.
Every 90 minutes. Yeah,
and so that gave it a real, you know, you've had one, what's going to happen next time? The clock is ticking. Yeah, I liked all that. And I understand your point about the shouldn't they know each other a bit better, but the dialogue with Houston didn't bother me because it felt like it was coming from some kind of NASA playbook, that the protocol would require you to ask for this or ask for that, and it didn't really seem to bother me that much. Jason, did it seem short to you, or did it seem like a, because it, you know, the Hollywood standard is a very long film.
It did not feel 90 minutes to me. Like, you know, when I saw Rush, for example, that we did talk about last week, I remember looking at my phone at some point and being like, wow, there's another hour to this movie. Not in terms of because it was dragging, but like now I'm thinking like, where can the story go for a whole another hour? In this, I don't think my hands came off, you know, arms of the chair. I'm sort of on the fence with Matt. Clooney was a little too Clooney. Like he wasn't as businessy as you would think he would have to be. And by business, I mean like, you know, a protocol guy. He was a little too like, hey, I'm the seasoned pro. I can be relaxed. You know, which I'm sure happens. I mean, I'm not an astronaut, nor do I know any. But it seemed like they picked Clooney for that purpose, that he's a good bullshitter. Like, he can, like, sort of just go, like, all right, Clooney. You know, someone had made a fake movie poster for Gravity with Clooney's face that says, oh, Houston, where art thou? Which I think is, you know.
Don't you feel that, like, the first Burton Batman, that the casting seemed odd before you saw the film, but after the film, Sandra Bullock seemed pretty reasonable choice. I mean, I think you wanted someone that wasn't... I would have been mortified if it had been a younger, pretty blonde actress with boobs and kind of a...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I like Sandra Bullock. I have no problem with Sandra Bullock. I think she's a good actress.
I liked her in this, too. I thought she was actually really well cast, and I thought she played the part of a... you know, doctor slash scientist astronaut really well. My only gripe, I guess, and it's a minor gripe. I mean, don't get me wrong. I want to make sure it's clear that, like, I found this film to be incredibly entertaining. And I think that, you know, Jason, what you said about, like, you know, kind of your hands on the armrest, like, I mean, I wasn't really conscious of it, but a couple times I did catch myself like, wow, like, you know, I'm really feeling like the intensity of the moment here in the scene. So it really definitely got to me.
So did you guys do what I do, which is that on that opening shot, turn to the person beside you several times and say, they still haven't cut.
Yeah. Oh, I knew it was a long opening shot, but the thing that's I did feel like I was going to puke when she was spinning a little bit, which I guess is fair. I saw it in IMAX 3D, which I feel like is the only way to see it, really. But I was a little like, whoa, like I could feel myself like, all right, I get it. But the thing that's interesting, what is it, like 200 cuts in this movie, max?
Well,
I mean,
we wrote the article here at FX Guide on the work of Framestore, but we researched the film. But we got special permission to run the story early from the studio and from the filmmaker, so I really do appreciate that. But we also found out a lot about the film that we weren't allowed to publish because we weren't allowed to, that most of the stuff was held back. But there was one bit that sort of slipped through the cracks, which I couldn't resist talking to John Montgomery about, which is that I got a press release that's embargoed, but one of the contributors, and I don't think I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, Rising Sun, said that they had worked on 17 shots. Just like, well, that's not much. I worked on 17 shots. And it was like for 2.5 minutes of screen time of visual effects. And I just was like, well, yeah, in this film, 17 shots. Like, I'd hate for someone to go and count, you know, like I worked on 3 shots in Gravity would normally mean, oh, so you really weren't on the show? On this, you could work on 3 shots in Gravity and you have done nothing else for the last 3 years.
Right. So I think it's interesting because it's mostly CG to... And because you lose sight of your main character and a lot of times to sort of perceive an edit is hard, right? In like what would be a long take. It feels like a long take, but in reality, there's a fake camera moving around until the real camera kicks back in and you see Sandra Bullock or something else. Like, it's not a traditional... I mean, there are traditional edit moments.
Sure.
But it's not a traditional, you know...
Yeah, I mean, in the Alfred Hitchcock film Rope, which theoretically had no edits in it, they had to have...
Edits.
Yeah, or a bunch of them, because they had to reload the film and the camera.
Right.
And what you're saying is that, obviously, the actors didn't have to sustain one piece of classic acting for the entire length of of the clip.
Right.
That being said... Editing is such a tool that, you know, you come to rely on. And I got to talk to Tim Weber, who was the VFX supervisor, and I was just saying to him then, and for those of you that can see this on the YouTube clip, I mean, if you've got a character that is coming towards you, normally you can just do a cutaway to get them from far away to close up pretty quick because you don't want to waste time in them getting up to camera. But here you didn't have that advantage, right? If you wanted to have the character far away and then close to camera, we had to stay on that shot most of the time for the duration of the move, which meant that in terms of choreography, it'd be very easy to have the audience suffering some dead patches just to sort of stay with the spirit of not doing the edits. And I didn't feel like that. I didn't feel like there were shots that I was just hanging on because the filmmakers were being obstinate in not cutting, as opposed to hanging on shots for a long time because they were immersing me in the drama. And I think that that is a sensational piece of virtual cinematography to not have me feel like, okay, I get it, you're not going to cut, but I really wish you would because it's kind of boring waiting for this character to come up for their close-up.
No, absolutely. I wasn't saying I didn't feel the edit from like a critical point of view. I think it's actually kind of masterful, like what you're saying, Mike, to be able to choreograph a scene that you know you can't mess with in the rules of physics, although they do with, you know, the rotation of the shuttle or the way something, you know, oh, that, like you said, it said in the article, it takes 50 minutes for the shuttle arm to retract. You know, obviously, they can't use most of the movie to do that. So they have to accelerate and do take some dramatic license. But for the most part, yeah, I agree with you. They had to figure out how to make that shot or a sequence be effective and engaging from every second. That's happening, and without gags. Right?
But I was going to say too that I think that the format, the IMAX 3D format, as well as the kind of the narrative environment of the space, right? The fact that it's a film that's taking place in, you know, relatively near Earth orbit, right, makes it something that is visually compelling on a number of levels beyond something that's editorially, you know, driven. And so, you know, when you look at most, you know, sort of pre-Hollywood IMAX films, that was always a big thing about IMAX, right, was this idea that the pace of the edit changes, and this, they take it to a much greater extreme, but the pace of the edit changes in IMAX based on the fact that it's so large. Like, if you have something that's really cutty in that format, it becomes really disorienting, I think, to the viewer too. So
I must admit, I did not see it in IMAX. I just saw it in stereo, because I was seeing it at a press screening. So it was in stereo, and I would not want to have seen it in mono, but I didn't have that IMAX experience. I think I would have found it more disorientating in terms of a nauseous kind of response to the floating in the IMAX, where it's much more sort of in your peripheral vision. But let's swing now to the actual visual effects. And I think, Matt, you made the reference to Avatar. The thing about this is, when we were in fully CG mode, which, let's face it, was quite a lot of screen time, it didn't feel cartoony or 3D. So the level of realism on a prop, on the detailing of the rivets, on the cloth sims of the outfits that either she was wearing inside or, for that matter, the space that's outside, and that's before we even hit the atmospherics and all the other stuff. I mean, it did look photoreal. Like, I wasn't conscious of a lot of shots where I was saying, okay, well, that's a good render, as opposed to, oh, my God, here comes a space station piece of debris.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the quality of the lighting, the quality of the materials, you know, that real sort of non-diffuse, very hard light that you sort of expect to see in something that's, you know, shot in space, right, in a vacuum. It's something we sort of become accustomed to seeing as sort of the look of something that's trying to look scientifically accurate anyway with regards to footage in space. And I thought the renders, the camera work, and the attention to detail too, the sort of the halation, the lens flare, the flaring of the lens, and the aberrations and stuff that you would see, the optical elements that were added as well, I thought really also gave a lot. And then when they would do things where visually, where they did this a number of times, where they put us inside of I guess it was the Sandra Bullock's character's spacesuit, and we were looking out through her visor, and I found that to be a really also incredibly effective way of both giving us, of course, her POV, but then also the kind of, the condensation and any kind of small scratches and stuff that were on that bubble. It also gave a veneer, a kind of a realistic veneer to all the computer-generated work that was sort of behind it as well, and I thought it added a great deal when they put it into that context.
Yeah, I've got to say that breath stuff, which we heard from Tim at Frameworks, was done in 2D, just meticulously, people comping in those breaths and stuff. But all of that stuff gave it a claustrophobic feel as well. Like, this idea that here I am sitting here and there's this thin thing between me and the infinite, sort of, you know, classically, I'm going to die at deep space kind of thing, I thought was sensational.
Well, and they had that in the prologue too, the little bits about the very, very beginning of the film, where they talk about space and the environment of space, and that, you know, it's what do they say in there? Something about it's uninhabitable, and it's to survive in space or something, it's an impossibility or whatever, right?
Well, and they say that sound, there's no sound because there's no atmosphere to carry the sound, which,
right,
you don't even realize until halfway through the movie, that even though you see the big, you know, destruction scene in the beginning, you don't realize really that there's not a lot, there's no sound. I mean, it's very low sub rumbles and stuff because those waves are bigger, but in reality, there's almost no destruction or physics sounds other than her voice and breathing,
yeah,
which is really hard to maintain. Like, you're used to these deafening, you know, destruction sequences where you're seeing a building collapse and you're hearing the most ridiculous sound design.
And similarly, no fireballs and, you know,
exactly,
enormous plumes of smoke and stuff. A lot of the,
right,
things that we would actually normally use to sort of envelop an event like that, which I actually think in one sense was really nice because I'm a big fan of the destruction sims and the nature of doing those and the way that they fracture a surface and break them up into subparticles and stuff. And sometimes I've seen in making ofs really great destruction sequences only to then in the film have it hidden by the smoke and the debris and the flames and stuff, and they envelop it and very quickly you don't see it. So a good example of that was in Mission Impossible in Moscow, where I think ILM blew up the Kremlin, and I saw the Kremlin go before they put in the smoke and the flames and the other stuff, and it was really interesting. And then the one you saw in the film was very realistic, and so it kind of happening, but there's a lot of stuff between me and it, and I don't really see what's going on. And it was right. Like, yeah, kind of at a mathematical level, really like seeing that. So that's kind of interest. But I guess we should really swing our attention to is this phenomenally interesting way upon which they filmed the lead actors. In particular, we'll talk about Sandra Bullock, though it also applied to George Clooney, which is the idea of having an actor trying to portray zero gravity and not using the Apollo 13 solution of putting them actually in the vomit comet so they would get the... sort of, you know, 20 seconds, as it were, of actual kind of free fall that was filmed very effectively, I think, in Apollo 13, but wouldn't give you a long enough for a long take that we're seeing in this film. So, I don't know, Matt, do you want to just discuss that? Because sometimes we've seen people in zero-G and it's been pretty convincing, especially on a close-up when they're just sort of sitting on a seesaw or some mechanism that's causing them to kind of float around. But we've also seen people in zero-G on wires where it's pretty obvious that there's a hip pivot point and their weight is being suspended. And every time they go to flip upside down, their hands come into their body so as to not, you know, get in the way of the wires. And it's kind of lame. And obviously this wasn't. Do you want to discuss that zero-G problem?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's something that, you know, we've seen in a number of films where they try to do it successfully. The most famous, of course, like you mentioned, right, is being the Apollo 13 where they get up in the vomit comet, where they're flying those parabolic arcs, and they're able to achieve a zero gravity kind of synthesis as they're in free fall. And if I understand correctly, now I didn't get a chance because I did just see the movie today, and I did get a chance to do a whole lot of research on the VFX. But it was my understanding, right, that they did a lot of stuff using that. What is that thing called? The
Botan-Dollis.
Yeah, Bottom the iris dollar, system, yeah. Right? Yeah, and so they were doing a lot of work, both moving the actors around, in some cases with the system, but weren't they also doing a lot of work where the camera was actually moving and that the actress or the actor was stationary and it gave the appearance of them kind of spinning around in space? So, you know, there's sort of a different technique, right, where the camera's moving as opposed to the actor, and I think it. As far as I'm concerned, you know, the achievement of the zero gravity look in the film when she's passing through the space station locales, but also certainly in all the exteriors. I mean, they're phenomenal. I don't think they suffer in any capacity from being done in a, you know, maybe using a different technique. I think this technique was incredibly successful.
Yeah, I mean, just for those that don't know, let me just quickly give a background, and this is covered in our FX Guide article, but there are a number of techniques used. There are people on wires, or there is puppeteering of Sandra Bullock, for example, for some shots, and there is literally her sitting on a seat, like a bicycle seat, and being seesawed up and down for some other shots. But the two interesting ones from our point of view, technically, are the ones where either they're just capturing her face and putting it onto a digital body inside a digital suit, inside a digital environment, so they're just literally lifting her face off, or they're partially taking her, so they're taking maybe an arm and her upper torso and then replacing it sort of somewhere mid-drift all the way down to the bottom. And so a good example of those two is exterior to the spaceship, where she's in a suit and we're only seeing her face through the visor. And then the other one, of course, is when she gets into the International Space Station and she zooms through. Now, in the case of the light box we're talking about, if you haven't seen any of the imagery, let me just quickly explain it and I'll swing over to you, Jason. But the idea is that, and this has been some time in development, it's sort of traced back to work done at USC and ICT in about 2002, 2003, but there was then the light sphere, which was called light stage, and you would stand in this light stage and they could, and I've done it, I've stood in the light stage and they put an HDR file, in other words, a high dynamic range picture, into the ball, as it were. And so if in the picture which is a 360-degree view of, in my case, it was a cathedral. If there was a window on the right, I could see that the lights were lit up where that window would be on the right for me. And if there was a sort of a yellowy building part, like a column on my left, well, then the lights on that side were that darker column colour. And thus my face was lit by the bright light from my right and the column from my left. But I was inside a sphere and it was just for a facial capture. What they did in this film is take that another step further, something that had been suggested by the original researchers, which is literally build a video jumbotron box, is probably the best way to describe it. And so you don't just have lights up, lights lighting you up with the correct lighting that would be coming from the correct direction. You actually see the darn thing. You can look to your right and you actually see, in this case, Earth. And if you look to your left and the space station was there, you'd actually see the space station. And thus it was that I would get, you know, a lot of bounce light if I was the actress or actor coming from my right where the Earth was, and a little bit from the bounce off the space station from my left. And you would have me sitting in a basket, I guess is the best way to describe it, a rig, and that would be able to puppeteer me around. So if it required me to turn 45 degrees to the right, the whole mechanism inside that box would turn 45 to the right. But of course, if I had the fly at the camera, you can't move me in the, well, I guess you could move me in the box, but it'd be kind of hard work. It's just much easier to move the camera. So the other side of this equation, the other really key component is what Jason was just referring to, which is this bot and dolly. Now, this is best way to think of it. One of those robotic arms you've seen in any program about spray painting cars at a factory in Detroit, right? A very big, very clever, very expensive robotic arm that's on a track, and it could fly at 4 meters per second, and it could literally run down this track and stop within, I think, 0.08 of a millimeter. So if you needed it to fly at my face, and assuming my face didn't move forward, it would stop exactly where it should, like millimeters in front of where I was, because it's completely computer controlled, it's completely repeatable. The big point about this, apart from the innovation in actually setting this rig up and doing it, and Jason, this is the one to get your opinion, is that you had to completely pre-make the film. Because all very well saying what I just said, but if I don't know that I want the planet to my right and the space station to my left, if I don't know I want the camera to fly at my eye at that particular point in the script, I'm dead in the water, right? I have to have rented the space station, rendered the planet, and know the camera move.
Yeah, I mean, before I saw the movie, I read an article with Cuarón where he said it took him 4.5 years to make this movie, and he'll never make a space movie again because it took him a year and a half or 2 years between refining the script and programming all the previs to essentially make the whole film, tweak the script, do, you know, I'm sure bring in voice actors. Maybe they had Clooney and Sandra Bullock come in and pre-voice, you know, some scratches, I don't know. But you had to pre-vis the entire movie. Now, people do that, like Fincher does that, but he's doing that so he can build sets and know exactly what walls he can move and what can be functional to moves, like he did that with Panic Room. But in this case, you're literally building your full environment that you're actually going to use, right? Choreographed, like you were saying, Mike. So your camera moves that you're doing aren't to be like, oh, that's cool, yeah, we'll approximate that on set. It's like, no, that's your move. You're signing off on that move, and a robot is going to move the camera exactly the way you did that. So now Sandra Bullock has to learn those moves and coordinate her moves exactly to the camera. Now, I'm sure she had some freedom of movement, but they had said that there were certain moments that had to be exactly the same as the previs. So her hand had to go exactly here and stop right in this spot, or it just wouldn't work. And apparently she nailed it every time. But then you have to take that and then completely remake the movie around your performances that you captured. So, I mean, the amount of effort in this is insane. But the bot and dolly, I think, was a really brilliant idea. And I guess the team had been assembled to create the technology that became bot and dolly, but it wasn't bot and dolly at the time, right?
Yeah. In fact, they San Francisco outfit, they came together. And it's kind of interesting, actually, because in a year period of R&D that the studio and the director had in America, they put together what they were going to sort of do on this, and they sort of came up with this approach. So there is, we've published some of it, footage of stuff that Chris Watts did. Now, Chris Watts was the visual effects consultant. So in this early day, when we were exploring it, not uncommon to do this, right? And Chris didn't continue on to London, though the Bott and Dolly guys that he went to and worked out the rig did go over to London. But it's, you know, completely reasonable that someone, in fact, quite often third floor, who are involved in the previews with Framestore in doing this very film. You know, we've spoken to those guys in the past and they've actually previewed up entire sequences to get the film green lit. So a lot of this stuff happens before the film is made. But in this particular case, yes, Chris went to those guys and said, we'd need to kind of do this. And they built these robotic arms and they were so successful that they went on. And in fact, you can now hire those rigs. And we've got a link to a YouTube where they were at Cinegear showing off the rig. And it's now very, it's not really one rig, it's multiple rigs and it's scalable in its size. But I think your point is really good, Jason, that you make the whole film first as an animatic. You then make the film on set, and what a fun set that would be to walk on. And then the third thing is you have to then rebuild it all around the performance you actually got, because there will be serious contributions by the actors, subtleties in timing and stuff that you'll have to to work to. And I think that...
Well, the other...
I was going to say, just that the endearing image for me is the idea of walking on set of Gravity, right? Because who hasn't walked on set? And we obviously all have. And you walk on set and there's like craft services and there's like a lot of people doing their jobs and there's a lot of people standing over here ready to do a job if it's required. And then over here, there's the main set and you've got a ton of lights leading into that little kind of area. And there's another pre-build of another set going on over here. And finally, you get into the set and there's like clapper loaders and DOPs and camera operators and a ton of people standing around and monitors and splits and hair and makeup to one side. It's just, you know, it's a big palaver, lot of lights, a lot of stuff, a lot of props. And it's a village, right? If you walked onto the Gravity set at particular points when they were filming it, obviously not the whole time, you would have basically large robotic track, box, actress in box, bunch of bright guys sitting with laptops in a line operating.
Yeah. but what's interesting is that, you know, to solve one problem, you introduce other problems. So it's finding which problem is the one you want to deal with in post or in production, and maybe even how cheap, which one's cheaper, which one's easier to solve. In this case, you know, you could do it all on a green screen, but then you're dealing with, you know, lighting issues because you're not comping into anything that you could even deal with spill in any fashion, right? But in this case, the light box is brilliant because you can get that. And I was on the stage with you, Mike, at Paul DeBevick's when you went in the light stage, and it was incredible to see all the lights projected on your face. It was like, you know, super fast, every possible light angle in like 2 seconds. But to use the Jumbotron box for that, to capture the actual real, you know, illuminated light, which you, of course, I would want as a director. I would be like, no, I want as much real reflected light on these people as possible, means that now everything is roto. Like, you have to roto every bit of, now luckily there's no hair, right, because she's got a helmet on, so at least you're dealing with generally round, nice fluffy round shapes because it's gloves and those are all fake anyway. At that point, they're just pulling out the face or whatever. So that in that case, that was the best solution for that. But being able to move the camera in and around because there's no actual physical environment to replace, like a ground plane, it was a brilliant choice.
Well, and as a solution too, I think, you know, if you describe, you know, the initial impulse maybe 5 or 6 years ago would have been, all right, well, we'll do this with a ton of green screen work, and it would have been, you know, a different looking film, but using
it would have been like a big gimbal arm, would have been a giant, basically a technocrane arm with an actor stuck to it,
right?
Yeah. Which would be terrible,
Matt. The other thing,
terrifying.
But the other thing that we don't want to sort of, you know, not give credit to is that that's got us a realistic face of Sandra Bullock going into a CG environment. But had Tim and the team at Framestore not done such an incredibly good job implementing a physically plausible shading and lighting model, which they did through the Arnold renderer, we just wouldn't have had such believable environments and believable props and believable stuff to then, you know, I mean, the quality of the rendering was just spectacular, and that's completely separate, if you, in one sense, from what they were getting on stage with this light box.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think, you know, all of that material coming together, and I know they were saying some of the Arnold renders, there was so much material in there, they were, I mean, the renders were taking, you know, a huge amount of time, but I think, you know, what they wind up getting on screen, I mean, I really, I'm not joking when I say that I really think this is an unparalleled feat of visual effects. I think, you know, the combination of, you know, creative filmmaking techniques in conjunction with the, you know, incredibly excellent work of all the visual effects artists working on this film. I mean, it comes together in a way to create a product that is, you know, for my, you know, $14 or whatever I paid to see this. I mean, it's definitely unlike anything I've ever seen. And I think, you know, it's one of those ones where, you know, I just can't imagine. The whole time watching this movie, I had that feeling that I know we've talked about a few times in the past on this program. You know, when you feel like you're really seeing something new, or you feel like you're seeing something that's breaking new ground, and varying technologies are coalescing in a way to create something that's really fresh and really just new, unique. And this is definitely one of those movies where I felt like from the opening frame, you know, to the when she finally splashes down back on Earth, I felt like I was constantly seeing something that was both incredibly believable, but also really challenging, you know, intellectually and you know, from an industry point of view to think about, well, how did they achieve that looking at it? It was really just so impressive in that respect.
My favorite quote, Matt, from Tim was that one of the guys in the IT department at Framestore, because they had a big render farm, of course, and they were distributing, they were very, very serious renders with multi-core machines. But one of them said to himself, I wonder how long it would take to render this shot if we'd only used one machine and not a multi-core machine at that. Like, when would you have had to have started the render for it to finish in time for the film to be used? And the answer they worked out was basically at the dawn of Egyptian civilization around 5000 BC.
That's awesome.
If you could go back in time, somehow generate 110 volts, plug your computer in, and set it to don't go to screen saver, don't do sleep shutdown, and come back today, yes, 5,000 years BC to today, it would actually have it rendered, which, you know, would be really helpful.
Well, you mentioned, too, earlier, Mike, the idea of some of those destruction sims, and there's three probably really great sequences of destruction that take place in this film, the initial destruction of the space shuttle vehicle, and then the two space stations that are destroyed in sort of two slightly different ways, right? One via mostly the debris, the second partially through debris and through, I guess, the heated friction of, you know, descending from orbit. And I thought that the number of, particularly in the large space station destruction sequence where the capsule is... the Soyuz capsule chute is extended already, and she's trying to sort of get away in the little Russian spacecraft. And I think that that destruction sequence, it's all taking place behind her. The number of elements that you see in that scene, and the sort of photorealism of each of those as well, in the context, even of a large scale IMAX frame, and the trajectory of all those differing particles and the sort of interaction of them was really just an amazing visual that, again, felt like something that was, you know, pretty groundbreaking in terms of the effects animation.
Yeah, I've got to say, Jason, that scene when she's out trying to get the debris going to start coming, she can't get breaking free because of the chute, and there's a wrench that she's using, and it starts drifting off. And, Jason, I don't know about you, but I saw this tweet that said... somewhere in heaven, Hitchcock was smiling. And for me, it was just like, oh, man. I was like, get the wrench. And then, like, there's stuff coming in, and I completely lost it. But, hey, get back to some of the visual effects stuff. The other thing that was incredible is this, the amount of data this thing used. And luckily, the IT department, again, at Framestore was on top of it. But I think they had more data in this than they did in all of Avatar by about, by my guesstimate, not by theirs, about 20%. So it was a huge amount of data to be dealing with. I mean, you know, vast amounts of stuff. When you consider how many characters there were in Avatar and how, I mean, you think about that tree and the forest and all that kind of stuff, and we've got an environment in space where you don't have that much stuff. It gives you an idea of the level of detail and the stuff that the guys had gone to have that kind of level of data and that much stuff. I think we lost Jason, but that's all right. We'll try and get him back while we're talking. Jason's coming to us from New York, where he's on an iPad, just generally pushing the boundaries of our own little tech here as hard as he can.
Mike, did you happen to know? I was just curious, looking at the story. I was wondering if you happened to notice if they were were they using any deep compositing in their pipeline?
I don't think they were using deep compositing, from what I can ascertain. It's a great question. I wish I had a definitive answer to that. I believe that they weren't.
Yeah, just when you mentioned the amount of data,
it's possible they did. Like, yeah. If anyone knows the answer to that, please let me know. I should know the answer to that. Can I ask you about the ending of the film that comes down to Earth and lands in some place? And obviously, I was quite convinced she was going to die at the end, because I thought it'd just be really funny, wouldn't it? She just like managed to get it down. No one knew she got it down because all the communications were out, and she drowned. That would be a really, really good ending. Not that I thought they were going to have a sequel to this anyway, because I don't think you should even get up in a plane, let alone a space station. But what did you think about that coming down to Earth sequence? And in particular, I mean, it's one of the completely, I mean, it's so hard to think of gravity and think of her splashing around in water with the water rushing into the spaceship and going down underneath. But Jason, now you're back. What did you think?
It was incredibly tense. I mean, you know, you're not, you hope that she's going to make it back to Earth, because I mean, there's obviously a tremendous amount of good fortune and things, you know, good fortune smiling on her to make certain things happen that allow her to get back to Earth. But for her to get back to Earth and have just sort of the same weightlessness, right? But she's in water, and now it's an environment she can survive in some fashion out of the suit with the same weightlessness. And now she has another problem, is she can't breathe. You know, she wouldn't be able to breathe in space, but she'd die instantly. Now she can be in this other weightless environment that she has to escape, but now she has friction and other things that she has to contend with until she finally breaks out. I thought they did it gave you just enough thought that maybe she wouldn't make it, so that when she breaks out, it's this sort of Promethean rebirth, you know. And
I think cinematically too, it's a really great juxtaposition of the two sort of hostile to human environments, right? I mean,
right.
She's in space; she needs the suit in order to survive. But then when she's finally back on Earth and she's sort of, ejects from the capsule and has to wait for the pressure to kind of equalize water pressure wise as the water's running in before she can swim out, it's the suit that was protecting her in space that actually prevents her from being able to get up to the surface, because, it fills with water and, whatever, it makes it really difficult to swim. And I thought that the juxtaposition of those two things, that she's, never quite out of the fire, as it were, and then they conclude it with her sort of, resting on the beach and then even stumbling for a brief moment on the beach, in response to now being in full, Earth gravity back on terra firma or whatever. And I thought that that was really, it hit home the point, she kind of chuckles even in the film, in that sequence. And I thought it really drove home the point of sort of it harkened back to those lines that were in the sort of prologue at the very beginning of the film about the hostile nature of that environment and how it's sort of the antithesis of an environment that could support human life. And it kind of brought it back, I think. And so, I don't know, I really liked it. I thought it was,
I also liked how they kept the camera low, so she looked kind of like big and like it gave her that sort of Citizen Kane-esque, she triumphed over her.
I had the apes in 2001 for some reason.
somebody tweeted, if only she had looked up and seen the Statue of Liberty's head on the beach, that would have, you know, sealed the deal. I would have made
if they'd cast like Abe Bogota instead of Sandra Bullock, maybe.
I'd have been happy if she looked up and saw a large obelisk. That would have been good enough for me. So do we think this is an isolated technical achievement relevant only to this film, or do we think that this style of virtualizing an environment into a cube-type audio map with a robotic-controlled arm, does this have any validity beyond the next Star Wars or any other reason for doing a zero-G kind of thing? I mean, is this good if you're doing Star Trek and want to do something in zero-G coming up? Otherwise, it's going to be a technique that, you know, is very particular and only used in Gravity?
No, because imagine if you put somebody on a treadmill, you know, walking towards you, and if you were going to completely remove them and you took an Epic and put it on its side, and now you're recording, you know, or even if you have the Dragon sensor and you're recording 6,000 pixels tall, right, because you're just chopping them out, and you have the light box with they're walking down a fake street or whatever. I mean, I don't think gravity per se is the limiting factor on using the rig for something, right? Because you could do the thing could even function as a Steadicam. You could do a Steadicam shot on a light in the light box. Camera comes in on the feet, comes up to the head. Things, environment, you know, digital environment reacting around them.
Matt, do you think it scales? Matt, do you think we could see like this cage, this box was the dimensions are published in the FX guide, but let's for argument's sake say that it's, you know, I don't know, 18, 20 feet kind of from side to side. I don't know what she was. I could look it up. But what do we think? Do we think, there we go, so 20 feet tall, 10 feet wide. Do we think that you could scale this up and have something that could hold two actors in it, three, having a...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it would depend on a couple factors, I suppose. You know, like what is the throw distance of the LEDs that are on each panel? Like, you know, at a certain point, does the box get so big that it almost becomes... it becomes less relevant as a generator of lighting or reflection or whatever, and it becomes something that's really just kind of more, you don't think?
No, I mean, I'm saying think about the Sky Tower in Oblivion. That was a giant projection map.
Yeah,
because
that's true.
That was real footage being projected at some insane brightness at like 4K, and that footage was being used not only to show
the unknown here, but it looks like from the images of the lightbox system, the resolution of the projection that you're referring to is certainly much higher than the resolution that you're getting from the lightbox setup. So, you know, I mean, I think the lightbox setup, though, is interesting in that, you know, it's like a real-world proxy for a, you know, like an animated Cornell box or something, right, where you're getting all of this information so quickly from something that's essentially it's all happening in real time. You're capturing it in camera, and that's something that that data set, that information, could be useful, like you're saying, Jason. I think it's so many different cases. How well it would scale, like, you know, I don't know. It's hard. That's a hard one to say.
Well, actually, I think Jason's brought up a really good point. If you could make a cross between the Oblivion, which is a series of projectors, for those of you that didn't listen to our VFX show on that one, there's a series of projectors projecting on a giant psych that produced the out-the-window for Tom Cruise and his character to look at. If you did a cross of that, because that was only sort of looking in one direction, but somehow managed to have very high-speed projectors projecting in basically, what, about 270 degrees? We don't need 360 because the ground plane you're standing on has its own validity. All the surfaces in Oblivion were reflecting correctly the sky. If there was a shiny surface, it was not reflecting a green screen. It was reflecting the sky.
And it's gorgeous.
Now, the problem with that, with the light box, is that it's not designed for that kind of, you would see the reflection of the little LEDs. But if you could go somewhere in between, and Lord only knows, this is an area that has enough R&D being pumped into it, because projectors, screens, 4 and 6K, I mean, that's exactly what you would need to have to be able to pull this off. And there's no reason
I'm sure you could create a higher resolution light box, right, where you had, like, you know, four times the number of LEDs somehow, right? You know, like some real, you know,
or if you're using
more dense panel.
If you're using an actual 4K panel TV.
Yeah, a bunch of 4K TVs. I mean, let's literally think outside the box here and say, you know, you're on a $200 million film. why don't you just build any, you know, small soundstage out of 4K TVs? Now, it's going to cost a fortune, but at a $115 million film, you've got a fortune. So,
yeah.
I guess the thing is, it does come out of light levels that you can get out of these things. And, you know, it'd be very hard to get the kind of intensity of light out of one of these things that we would see from a natural exterior light source, for example, like the sun. But for a lot of other applications, it's a matter of scaling it up.
If I remember correctly, too, that was one of the things that came up in the conversation around the projections for Oblivion. And I don't know if it was the case with the light box, but there was some discussion around Oblivion about it was challenging at times and difficult to get all the projectors in sync, right, where they were all
kind of... Oh, I'm sure.
Oh, actually, I think... No, I mean, look, obviously there probably was, but I think in general, the takeout I got was that actually the team on Oblivion did a spectacularly good job at keeping those projectors in sync and lined up and not, you know, the director could say, hey, I want the sun later in the day, and they just wind it in and it would not take a lot of time to change. But the throw distance in Oblivion was so large that, you know, dramatically reduced the light levels coming back, and thus, of course, you know, by the nature of the physics, you had to be fairly wide open. But if you reduce the size of the Oblivion box, but increase the size of the light box from this film, surely there's a midpoint with sort of much higher res stuff that somebody's going to try. And the thing that you would do is you'd walk into a meeting today and you'd say, I want to do this technique, which is an extension of that film Gravity, which, by the way, was really hugely successful. And then you'd assume that all of the success was down to how clever the light box was, and try and get somebody to green light it. Now, we know, obviously, there's a lot of reasons why Gravity worked, but nothing, you know, success has lots of parents. And some, a lot of people would be, I'm sure, seeing if they could take this further. I think it's really exciting where it could go. But I think it was a great...
Can I say...
Yeah.
Can I say that I pride myself on being a bastard while I watch movies and being able, like, just, like, nitpicking the shit out of plot and the thing and being like, no, that would never happen. I'm so clever. I figured it out, which, you know, Moon was the ultimate, you know, slap for people like me that like to try and figure it out. But in this case, it was the reverse. Like, I didn't think there was anything to figure out, so I sort of just forgot all that stuff, and I was just watching the movie to the point where when Clooney comes back into the pod and opens the door, like, I immediately turned to my friend and goes, and I said, that's total bullshit. She'd be frozen to death. And he looks at me and he goes, it's a dream sequence, dumbass. And I was like, oh, right. Like, I just completely, that whole part of my brain was just switched off, and I was just literally just enjoying a movie for once.
Just such an American,
you know, very rare.
So just such a New York kind of, it's a dream sequence, dumbass.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure that's how you guys roll in New York. No, I sort of know what you mean, though. I did the same thing. That was the first point I went, hang on a second. I mean, then look, I don't think there's any benefit in being a bastard and criticizing. I mean, you can. People have been publishing on the net like crazy. The fact that the orbits are at the wrong heights, that the distance
is
between
the space.
I don't care. It's a film. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And same thing with the time dilation, you know. Yes, okay, some things happen quicker than others, but for going out loud, it's a film. You know, I did think it was interesting that Buzz Aldrin was asked to review the film, and he thought it was pretty good. He thought there should be more clouds on Earth, but apart from that, he thought it was pretty good. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting when you get to that point. I am living in fear of getting to a point where none of the original Apollo astronauts are with us anymore.
We
don't have anyone that has a first-hand experience of what it's like to be on the moon, but obviously quite a few people have been at the space station. And been in orbit, but I thought the environmental shots of Earth were great. But look, I touched on one other point earlier. I just want to go back because I don't think I gave it enough credit. In each film, we quite often just try and do a bit of a shout out to one department that seems to have really excelled themselves. We could, I guess, give a shout out to the roto team here, and to a certain extent the stereo conversion team, though a bunch of this was rendered in stereo. I'd like to give a shout out to the guys that did the modeling, because there were periods in this that I started looking at the stuff that they were fixing that was out on that, I think it was the Hubble telescope, whatever it was, you know, like just down to the CPU boards and the bolts and the, like there was just so much wonderful attention to detail. so many great textures and just believable looking stuff that I've seen in, you know, IMAX, you know, Mir space station documentaries, whatever. It just looked so real. The modeling team.
I totally agree. I mean, 100%. And I think that the average viewer going to see this movie is going to watch those sequences at the beginning, and they're going to be like, oh, well, that's clearly, you know, there they are. They're in suits. This is some sort of a, like you said earlier, maybe it's some sort of green screen or something. You know, there is no hint to the average moviegoer that there is that much computer-generated imagery in the film. So,
This film was much more Toy Story than it was, you know, a live-action film. You know, like, I mean, this was really a lot closer to Toy Story than, you know.
Yeah, mark my words. I mean, this film will win the Oscar for visual effects, I guarantee it. Todd's Predictinator, I predict, the Predictinator will confirm what I'm saying here today.
I would say I agree, because leaving the movie, my brother and I were having a discussion whether or not they were ever in real spacesuits, because, you know, we were saying she could be in a spacesuit and it's the spacesuit that's comped in, or it could just be the face, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and we couldn't, until I read some articles and other things, I didn't know that it was literally just the face. Like, that's how good the suits were, and all, and agreeing to your points, both your points about the modeling, that it was, you could not tell other than actual stuff in space, like a space shuttle, which clearly would be CG, the suits, and, you know, even the, like, I felt like it was a little Zemeckis-y touches, like, you know, all the pens and shit floating around in the space station, and the reflecting on the sweat or the tear or whatever, you know, water globule, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, it all felt real.
Yeah, no, it's a spectacular film. And, you know.
Oh, Mike, so what did you think about the fire sims then? When she's in the.
The fire sims,
the fire was chasing.
Yeah, I thought the fire was pretty interesting. It's a big problem doing fire in zero G, because there's no heat rising characteristics for the flames. So right. I didn't want the flames.
It sort of goes everywhere.
Yeah, it sort of goes everywhere. You know, I don't know if you guys seen this, but there was an actual YouTube video of an actual experiment done in zero G where somebody got a wet towel and they squeezed the wet towel, and all the water just hangs on the wet towel because there's no gravity to cause it to separate from the wet towel, right? And
that's interesting.
And I had somebody saying to me, you light a match in a space station, which, by the way, would be a stupid thing to do. You light a match in a space station and it would go out because heat can't rise. So new oxygen can't get into the match to burn because it just gets enveloped by its own bubble of heat, and then it runs out of oxygen and stops burning, right?
Well, and I thought when she first arrives at the, I believe it's the, is that the, when she first arrives at the Chinese station, if I'm not mistaken, I think that's the part where she gets inside and she is passing, you know, sort of through some of the modules or whatever, and she passes one where there's and they turn and kind of focus on it. There's a small fire, and what I thought that they did was they had the fire elements, and some of the sparks were almost spherical, right? They looked more like plasma or something, like a superheated plasma rather than a than a flame. Yeah, I noticed that right away and thought, like, oh, that's so cool. Like, they're doing, you know, flame fire type effects in zero gravity. Like, that is what it would look like, I would think, you know. And the only time I think where it started to have a more kind of traditional Hollywood look was when the explosions of some of the, you know, tanks and things like that got larger, and then it kind of had a more traditional sort of billowy kind of gaseous kind of explosive feel, but it didn't bother me at all.
The show's nearly over, so we need to kind of wrap it up. But I guess we pretty much applauded it as being one of the, you know, best visual effects films we've seen in a while. It obviously worked so well, the three elements of storytelling, cinematography, and visual effects, that, you know, I don't know how they would sort of really spin them out. But I think the cinematography was terrific, but clearly the virtual cinematography was, you know, coming not from the DOP directly, but through his advice to the people doing the camera design work at the previous stage. So it's going to make a bit of a mockery when we get to the categories come Oscar time, other than visual effects, which, you know, and any concept that this is post-production has just gone right out the window. This is just completely production. I hope this is a good example of those things working together so we see more of this type of thing. But, you know, one can only hope. I do think, though, that the director was a good live-action director here on Earth, had a good sense of a whole lot of things, and then clearly had faith in these other department heads, even though they all had sort of overlapping roles. And I think that if you'd had somebody that was more dogmatic about just wanting to make it bigger, better, bolder, longer, it would have just, you know, gone awry. And it's amazing how little, I mean, there's like two deaths in this. Well, okay, there's four if you account for the people they find. But like, it's just not a, like, there's not a lot that really kind of happens. There's not a lot of sort of amazing sequences. It just sort of wove together so well. I just think it's a collaborative process as much as anything. And I just applaud the guys for doing such a great job. Hey, thank you guys for being with us on the show. We're running slow on time, so I need to quickly jump in and wind this up. But Matt, where can people track you down?
You can always find me at my place of work, which is the School of the Arts at Virginia Commonwealth University, where I'm the faculty advisor to our student CGRAPH group as well, and I think some of them may be watching right now. So,
apparently you also, and, you're behind the Occupy Me movement, given the thing on the wall behind you.
Oh yeah, my what's his name? Guy Fawkes mask back there. Yeah. No, I'm not a member of Anonymous, and if I was, I wouldn't be able to tell you. I think they all got arrested, right? But you can find me either at VCU or you can find me online at my website, which is mattwallen.com.
And Jason?
You can go to my website, thediamondburrows.com, or on the Twitters, just Jason Diamond.
And, of course, you can find me over at FX Guide. I'm on Twitter as Mike Seymour, but at FX Guide is where I hang. And not only is there this great Gravity story that we've been talking about that we've written up, but you can actually listen to the audio of the interview I did with Tim Weber. It's pretty much uncut as one of the FX podcasts. We've got a bunch of really cool stuff coming up. I think, from what I'm seeing from the guys in the control booth, that we did everything a lot better this week. So I want to thank the, you know, people that were with us. I can see that there were a bunch of people with us in the YouTube feed and the Google Hangouts. I thank them. I want to thank our technicians who've done a spectacularly good job in pulling this together, even though I made a last minute change 15, 20 minutes before we started. And thank you guys so much for supporting the VFX show. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you guys.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.